My guest today, Dylan Radigan. The topic, greedy bastards. Identifying the corporate, communists, and crook banksters and vampires feeding off Americans. I'm not going to limit our dialogue, but I am going to change how we would normally open. For those of you who are used to this program, we open with health and nutrition, environmental issues. We take on a social issue of the day that the media has refused to look at objectively and honestly, and then try to bring some scholarship, in-depth reasoning of how we can not just change something, but transform it. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm going to do an extensive introduction with a commentary I presented, and then we'll ask you to respond to it, if you would, please.
Wonderful.
One of the most famous examples of journalistic integrity has served as an exemplar of how journalism can correct wrongs and bring justice to bear. It's the story of Emile Zola, a French naturalist, writer, and supporter of political liberalization in the latter half of the 19th century. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with the case, it involves a Captain Alfred Dreyfus, an artillery officer in the French army who happened to have been Jewish. Following a scandal of French military secrets reaching the German embassy, growing anti-Semitism convicted Dreyfus on charges of treason leading to his imprisonment on Devil's Island in French Guiana. Although evidence was available, clearly, to implicate another officer, the right-wing French government and media refuted it and continued its original verdict against Dreyfus. Even the French officer, Lieutenant Colonel Picquart, who uncovered the officer who was the real spy, was himself sentenced to serve a term in prison. Hence, the cover-up was complete. Taking up the cause on behalf of Captain Dreyfus, Zola risked his career by composing an article entitled "I Accuse" that was printed on the front page of the Paris Daily. His article accused the highest echelons of French military and justice, and even the church, which held considerable power in France, of anti-Semitism and corruption in accusing Dreyfus. For his sense of justice, Zola was convicted for criminal libel, but rather than serving prison time, he fled to England and didn't return to France until the right-wing French administration fell. My question then is, who do we have in the mainstream media today who has the courage of Zola to not just take on an isolated case of injustice, but of hundreds of injustice, not just against an individual, but against almost 70% of a nation? By my statistics, which are careful and measured and accurate, more than 245 million Americans today live at the brink. Who are their advocates? I just completed an 81-day trip around the United States, traveling by car and filming for my latest documentary on Poverty, Inc. In that, I spoke with people who had college educations, people from all walks of life, and all had something in common. They all felt as if they had been victimized. And when I spent days with them, talking with a woman whose two teenage daughters, who had been in an upper-middle-class environment, whose husband was a physician, but after their divorce, his practice went down, child support diminished, she could not get a job, and finally they were homeless. And she talked about what it means to be homeless, when your neighbors don't come out to support you, when you are, in effect, taking your belongings to the curb, and they look at you through a window and then look away, when the marshals come and tell you have 1 hour to get out of the house. And she thought she never would see this day. Her teenage daughters in tears, what to do? What? Who's helping them? I'm angry. I am disturbed. Not because of so much suffering, but because of so much indifference to this suffering. Who stands up for these people? Who are their voices? I interviewed women who were in their 60s, who had worked diligently and honestly for 30 years. They opened up a door. Cat food. Cat food. That's all they could eat, because that's all they could afford. And so I wondered, where are the politicians right and left? Where are the administrations? Where are those who are supposed to be responsible for seeing that others are also cared for, who may in this hour of need not be able to care for themselves, who've done nothing wrong. They're not lazy. And so I'm angry about that. I'm angry that we have forgotten what it is to be compassionate to one another. That concerns me. But most of all, my concern is about we do not have the type of integrity that once existed in media, with few exceptions. And I believe the gentleman in studio is one of those exceptions. We need a lot of Dreyfus's cases today because we need to pay attention to the basics. Now for my what I believe should be a little different approach. We can go for the next 10 years accusing everyone of what they've done wrong. Will that get us where we need to go? Will that change the nature of the problem? Before we continue with our myth that 99% of Americans sleep on the side of angels and the 1% bask with devils, we need to ask ourselves why we constantly blame others for the choices we permit those who select and listen to and admire and put into power make on our behalf or we make for ourselves. What would happen if we stopped blaming the Clinton administration and Phil Gramm for eviscerating the Glass-Steagall Act and not allowing it to be reinstated, and altering the Commodity Futures Trading Act and neutering the Securities and Exchange Commission to assure Wall Street that no one among the most powerful elite would ever have to be subjected to scandal or legal action. Nor should we therefore blame Wall Street for its holding $100+ trillion among five banks in credit default swap and derivatives to continue their casino gambling and speculation, making money from money. So let us stop blaming the attorney generals from all states who wanted to penalize with a trivial $26 billion, that's less than 1 week's worth of profit for the major banks involved, or the tens of thousands of individuals working within the 6 million large financial industry who engaged in criminal behavior, liar loans, robo-signing, insider dealing, and instead allow them to get away with minuscule fines and nothing changing the system. Let us not blame the Federal Reserve, a private banking institution who dished out $16 trillion of taxpayer-guaranteed loans with toxic-valued assets and collateral at only 0.25% interest across 22,000 transactions, all done in secret to domestic and foreign banks, hedge funds, major corporations. Let us not blame Barack Obama and his administration for hiring only 1,627 former Washington insiders from both the Clinton and Bush administrations to continue the entrenchment of corporate power in our policy decision-making. Nor should we blame Barack Obama for exonerating all the crimes of the Bush-Cheney and their accomplices for knowingly creating secret intelligence offices in the vice president's office, which bypassed our national security apparatus in order to divine a rationale for going to war in the Middle East. As a constitutional scholar, let us not blame Barack Obama for undermining our constitutional liberties by supporting the Patriot Acts, the Homeland Security Act, FISA, and the new National Defense Authorization Act that consolidates more power in history over Americans without their input within his White House. Let us not blame the military-industrial intelligence gathering industry for its massive financial fraud and redundant operations amounting to approximately $1.3 trillion annually when every single authority of any scholarship shows that only $250 billion is actually necessary to properly keep Americans safe and to defend us. Let us not blame the Bush and Obama administrations for neglecting 12 million hungry American children. They wake up each day with not enough food. This is not Biafra. This is America. Or the 50 million Americans who are in deep poverty, so deep they must live off food stamps, or the 50 million Americans who are working but working poor, making so little they have to work at two jobs and are so deep in debt in their entire lifetime they will never see a free day of debt. And in the meantime, let us forgive the government for intentionally manipulating unemployment figures for political gain. At 8.3%, hardly, when you exclude all those who stop looking for work, and you exclude those who are working 1 hour a week who and then call them gainfully employed, you're at 21% unemployment. Let us not blame the House, the Senate, and the White House for supporting offshore drilling and billions of dollars in subsidies to clean air, nuclear, and hydrofracking natural gas while ignoring the cleaner, more efficient geothermal and wave energy technologies that haven't even been discussed, let alone funded at any level. Oh, and by the way, did I mention we have 22,000 geothermal springs in the United States, enough to adequately, inexpensively, and perpetually be able to heat or cool more than 14 million homes and businesses. Let us not blame any of the last five administrations for encouraging the Food and Drug Administration and the USDA to denounce complementary approaches for the prevention and treatment of disease while aligning federal health policy with the greed of Big Pharma and the private insurance carriers who virtually write off our health care system in our hands and give it exclusively to the big pharma, big insurance, health insurance, and big for-profit corporations. And also at the time, let us forgive those 14 members of the House who wrote, along with the pharmaceutical industry, the Medicare bill, which allowed the government to pay full price instead of inexpensive generic drugs, which have reaped an additional $1 trillion in profits to the pharmaceutical company over 10 years. Let us not blame our Surgeon General and the Secretary of Health and Human Services for failing to offer alternative health care choices nationwide. Rather, we should forgive the FDA its attacks on the natural and supplement industries, even preventing those who grow cherries and walnuts from suggesting these foods might actually help prevent certain illnesses. And while we're at it, let us forgive the FDA for permitting known pharmaceutical drugs that have been maiming and killing thousands of patients to continue to advertise and prescribe to patients with never a single suit against any of these companies, nor even Vioxx that killed 60,000, caused 125,000 heart attacks and strokes. Not a single person was penalized. Not a single corporation was fined more than $5.85 billion, and that was simply one quarter's profits, which was the cost of doing business. But that didn't include flowers for the bereaved at their funerals. No apologies from anyone in medicine. Let us not blame the lobbyists, the private consultants and experts, many of whom are former members of Congress or governmental agencies, who draft legislation that benefits their industries at the cost of the public good. Let us not blame anyone in government who says they're for reform and yet allows massive amounts of money to come from all different sources so we buy elections and make a farce of what we call democracy. When we have no democracy, we have a lottery. And to the largest who provides the most money, you just bought yourself politicians, and with it, you bought yourself the laws you want. Let us not blame American medicine for being the number one cause of death in the United States while ignoring any criticism about its methodologies, clinical support, or regulatory approval process. Last year, 627,000 Americans died because of iatrogenesis, and 13 million were injured. Or let me put it more succinctly, let us forgive and not blame American medicine in the last 20 years for causing the unnecessary deaths of 10 million Americans and injuring 192 million. Let us not blame mainstream media for offering products that promote disease such as obesity and diabetes causation in children and adults. Let us not blame the psychiatric industry for creating non-existing mental disorders such as oppositional defiance disorder in order to increase medication rates and drug sales profits. Let us not blame the mental health centers in our inner cities for spearheading community programs to diagnose upwards of 80% of all children that walk through their doors as having mental illness, giving them unnecessary tests such as teen screen and increasing medical diagnosis. We must also stop blaming credit card companies who receive government loans at 0.25% interest and are permitted then to charge 29% beginning interest on credit cards and up to 100% if you're late or miss payments. Let us not blame Walmart and major corporations for importing cheap, toxic products manufactured with slave labor. Let us not blame the five past administrations for pushing neoliberal free market globalization practices for their globalization partners. Nor should we blame the International Monetary Fund for the consequences of its draconian rules and structural readjustments, opening markets in poor countries for foreign economic colonization and exploitation. Let us not blame the American media for failing to look honestly at economic bubbles, equity partnership bubbles, hedge fund bubbles, subprime and commercial real estate bubbles, and then warning citizens in advance, which they never did. Let us not blame the economic experts who to this day paint a distorted picture of our recovering growing economy. let us not blame the love fest of the global elites at Davos and the business roundtable who believe their power, wealth, and class status permit them to devise and direct our domestic international policies without our vote. Let us not blame the FBI and CIA and Homeland Security for the militarization of our domestic police forces and their intrusion into our lives without warrant or due process, including their punishing the dissent of peaceful environmental and social protesters who find themselves an enemy terrorist because they're now on an FBI watch list. Let us stop blaming teachers for graduating illiterate students in their curriculums designed by private corporations that never challenge students to have the intellectual skills to be independent, creative, thinking human beings. Let us not blame the producers within the entertainment industry who inundate us with vulgar, mind-numbing, violent programs and movies carrying America to the bottom of our culture and etiquette, manners, decency, and ethos. Let us not blame the President and Congress failing to implement the moratorium on home foreclosures and providing small businesses that qualify with no-interest loans the same as they give the big banks, which could provide employment to millions of Americans at a living wage. We must also forgive the agro-industrial complex, the Monsantos and DuPonts of the world who seek the monopolization of global food and manipulate its current control through genetic engineering of seeds, along with Bill Gates. We must forgive all corporations who contribute to the pollution and destruction of our environment and do so with a wink and a smile. Let us cease blaming the corporate Democrats and the corporate Republicans and their mouthpieces in the media propagating rigid ideologies that only serve the interests of those in power and not the common people, for they most all disdain reason and ideas that are fluid and flexible, that come from the inner heart and speak to the heart with common sense and not a pedigree, a profusion behind the think tanks that dominate all guests on talk shows. And finally, let us stop blaming the U.S. military for causing the permanent disability and death of countless elderly and parents and children in the Middle East and forgive our media's refusal to acknowledge any of their suffering. And also, let us forgive all the administrations from JFK Ford who expanded the military-industrial complex for a global imperial overreach, sugar-coated in the rhetoric of freedom and democracy, while simultaneously supporting every dictatorship and despotic regime around the world that served our geopolitical interest. And while we're at it, let us also forgive corporate America's celebration of financial profits from offshore jobs while closing down 53,000 factories in the last 12 years. And did I also mention that under this a very important HB1 visa, we have imported 8.4 million well-educated foreigners to replace 8.4 million educated workers for one-third the salary? And when was the last time any media told you those figures? And finally, let us also not blame the Republicans for claiming to represent smaller, efficient government while supporting the largest social welfare system in history for large banks and major corporations in the form of grotesque bailouts and subsidies and socializing their losses while privatizing their profits. And when we cease to blame government, banks, corporations, the media, the influential policymakers, opinion leaders for the choices we have made, then we must ask what personal and collective responsibilities are there for the plight and crisis the nation is in. Since our current system of governance is beyond reform from within the system itself, are we then capable of disassociating ourselves from that dysfunction? And at this moment, individuals identifying themselves as independent thinkers, as progressive thinkers, represent 41% of the voting population. If you're among this group, you're in the majority, exceeding official Democrat and Republicans. Therefore, is it not time that we look to coalesce, to work together, individually and collectively, by standards of ethical behavior, by policies and democratic structures that fight for the common good? Otherwise, just continue watching Fox and the other major networks in order to perpetuate the Manichaean myth of 99 versus 1%. And the blame game goes on.
Here's how I look at the problem. You can see it everywhere, and you described it. At its essence, the common trait for the problem we are solving for is a systematic, a system by which we privatize all liability in our society right now for anything. Our healthcare liabilities, our educational failure liabilities, our energy mismanagement liabilities, our military liabilities, our financial liabilities are all given to the future and to the state effectively. And the benefits of the immediate services of food, of energy, of housing are increasingly diminishing in their availability while simultaneously becoming vastly more profitable for those who have the control over those assets, energy assets, housing assets, et cetera. So everybody's correctly observing the same thing, which is what you just articulated. There's a common thread with the whole inventory that you just offered, Gary, that is that, right? That is all examples of that. And so what we've learned over the past few years that gives us an opportunity to look at these problems in a way to solve them that is the next step, if you will. And I call it the 100% concept, or being the 100%. It's a very simple premise. When you look at the actual issues, you want to start where the symptoms are most acute. So there is a long inventory of issues that we have to deal with. But in order to understand and appropriately hotspot, which is what is possible now, which I'm about to get into, that's the magic trick to get out of this. And you want to start where it's most acute. So what is that? So I'm going to use a metaphor from my generation to describe a version of what you just offered. Imagine that we're all stuck, 311 million of us, in the trash compactor from Star Wars, the first movie. And everything that you just described is all the garbage in the swamp that we're sitting in the trash compactor. And the doors are closing. And one of the doors is austerity. You've got a bunch of people saying, well, we're just going to not feed people. That's how we're going to solve this. Like that's some sort of genius solution. Then you have another door closing that is, we're going to tax rich people. We're just going to take more money from rich people and that'll fix it. The problem with both of those things is that the size of our liabilities, A, is much larger than any tax levy we could offer would solve, or any deprivation of food could possibly muster in any society. Our liabilities are in the hundreds of trillions of dollars over the next 50, 60, 100 years in this country, depending. You don't even know what it is because of the invisibility of the financial structures and all the rest of it. But it is in the hundreds of trillions of dollars. That's an unresolvable mathematical problem. Remember, if you spent $1 million a day every day since Jesus Christ was born, you would not have spent $1 trillion today. And we're on the hook for hundreds of trillions of dollars mathematically. It's a fraud. So it shouldn't give you that much anxiety because it's never going to get paid. Okay. But that's what you understand. That's why the taxes and austerity are false solutions. And what we've fallen into is this dualistic construct, whether it's Republicans, Democrats, MSNBC, Fox, the occupation and the Tea Party, rich, poor, old, young, black, white, I don't care, that is predicated on hippies, straights, veterans, you know, pick them. That all of those structures are predicated on a fight between those two institutions, and the entire architecture in this country right now is entirely predicated on facilitating fighting. The Republican leadership wants a fight. The Democratic leadership wants a fight. The media wants a fight. The electoral – everything's set up for a fight. The genius of the current apparatus is that while that fight is happening, which is good economics and a great distraction and absolutely self-destructive and doesn't resolve anything that you've just described – simultaneous to that, it's not just that there's the money in our political system. The money in our political system is highly toxic, highly corrupting. We got to reduce it or get it out. Certainly make it transparent. We'll get into that. But beyond that, there's something else that makes the money really powerful that we all need to come to understand right now in this country and address directly. And it's this. Because 80% of American congressional districts are gerrymandered, they never change hands. Additionally, because the primary system is very small and closed, and the incumbent in a primary is almost never challenged because it is such a threat to the power structure of the DNC. Or the thing, if somebody wanted to do a primary challenge, the greatest example would be if somebody wanted to do a primary challenge on President Obama right now, which is within the threshold of our democracy. Eliot Spitzer could do a primary challenge to President Obama. Hillary Clinton could do a primary challenge. I'm not even advocating it. I'm telling you this is within the scope of our democracy today with all the horrible laws and all the things we know. We could do that right now, okay? So on a small scale, that never happens. Not only does that not happen with a sitting president, it doesn't happen with a congressman from Wyoming who's an incumbent. As a result of the lack of any primary challengers in any of our primaries, combined with the gerrymandering of our domestic political districts, we have effectively created thrones that we bequeath unto nobles in our country that we appoint as theoretical Democrat or Republican representatives, in quotations. And the reason for that is because they draw their own districts and they have all this influence over the incumbency bias in that situation. Once as a congressperson, Gary, you have complete security over your territory because of gerrymandering and the lack of primary challengers, your ability to oblige the money that we all so revile explodes. There's no greater inhibitor in the short term to your obligations to the money of the drug companies, the defense companies, the oil companies, the banks, whatever the money might be, than the certainty that the apparent receipt of that money will be a direct threat to your job by virtue of the fact that you actually can be dislodged in the primaries and in your district. But as long as we have that frozen block allocation of power through the closed primaries and the gerrymandering, it really empowers the special interests, not just with money, but in any way possible. We have to understand that in order to understand how we're going to fix the system. The reason I spend so much time on that one, so we can say, okay, I'm a big advocate of a constitutional amendment, a 28th constitutional amendment, to declare that corporations are not people and money is not speech, which is kind of an absurdity because we all know corporations are not people and money is not speech. Corporations are a tool and money is property. Both have value. Neither of us are speech or human. But regardless of whether we solve that one problem, we know that really dealing with this is a lifestyle. There's not a single silver bullet, some amendment that's going to solve it. What we're adopting is a lifestyle. And so the question that you really need to answer from me, I believe, is what is that lifestyle? So let's walk through my hometown of Saranac Lake, which is 6,000 people. It's about an hour south of Canada. And it's in addition to some time out in California and Colorado in my early childhood where I grew up. It's a small town in America. Many of the people who live in Saranac Lake still observe many of the same problems that you observe. They may not have as much detail or specific information about each of the given prosecutions of a given issue that somebody like yourself does, but they have most certainly a base awareness of all of the dysfunction and misaligned interest and extraction and exploitation that has sort of overcome the culture in our country. They know that the banks are too big and are extracting, not investing. They know that trade with China is rigged. They know that they can't really do anything about that. They can give some money. They can go on the internet. They can raise their voice. But I've found that as I've been traveling around the country, it's very frustrating to only have to stop at that point. It's been very frustrating for me to feel like I can only stop by talking about it. And so here's what I've discovered. And what I'll lay out right now is something you can do right now starting today. Here we are in Saranac Lake or every other city in America today. I break it into four categories. Community health, I'll come back to it. Physical health, the health services in your town. And educational health, the way your schools are functioning in your town right now. And then finally, local, domestic, meaning your town, your city, your county government. Transparency in that government and a redistricting and electoral reform in that government. So I'll do four things for you. First, on community health, what we have discovered in the context of our ability to keep track of more information is that whether it's with community health, crime, violent crime in a city or a small town, whether it is a big problem with health expenses in a given city or a given community or a given whatever it is, diabetes, obesity, these types of things, whether it is school systems that are not demanding mastery and creating a culture of experimentation and group-based problem solving, which is how human beings learn. We know that that's the best way human beings learn is through a culture of constant experimentation, failure, and then expectations of mastery. That's why they teach martial arts. You don't have to get a 70 to get a black belt. You know what I'm saying? You got to get 100. But you know, there's a culture of extensive experimentation and practice and acceptance of failure, and that progression. Our society right now, when it comes to education and really life, has put avoidance of failure as the paramount, as the ultimate thing to be avoided. Failed career, failed relationship, failed business, failed anything. And what we've traded failure in for is mediocrity. And what we're calling for from all of ourselves as we get into what I'm about to do with these four things is a spiritual change in our in ourselves, where we move from a terror of the concept of failure in acceptance of mediocrity to an embracing, a joyful embracing of a culture of experimentation with the necessary framing to do that. What's the goal of the experiment? What are the how are you going to measure how the experiment is going? Everything you do in your life is an experiment. And as we realize that, and then you say, okay, I'm going to see how this goes, and then as I go, when I'll learn, that you then get to mastery with failures along the way, which you learn unbelievable amounts from, and then when you talk to each other about it, the rate of learning explodes and the rate of adaptation explodes, and all of a sudden you've got a lot of things like what I'm about to describe to you in these four categories: community health, health, physical health, education, and electoral. First, it's the easiest to understand, I think, and the most sort of profound is on personal health. Right now in America, we spend money by the trillion into all sorts of rigged systems, financing the drug companies, private health insurance monopolies. There's an egregious layer of misaligned interest. The AMA restricts the number of doctors that can be certified in order to preserve pricing for doctors, as opposed to creating more doctors when the baby boomers are becoming this massive aging generation. It's insane what we're doing. Anyway, so understanding that, and then understanding, okay, that's the problem, and understanding, well, what is the where does the money actually go, is the first question you have to ask yourself. And so what we know in America is that 50%, half of the healthcare dollars in America, are spent on 5% of the American population. Half the money for all the healthcare in America goes to 5% of our population. That's not because those 5% are bad people spending all of our healthcare money. It's because they're the ones who are sick. And 95% of us are not sick, thank you very much for the day. And as a result, we don't spend as much healthcare money. That's a natural misalignment of how we spend money between those who are in need of health care or health attention, really sickness treatment is what we're selling, which is a different conversation, and then those who are not. Okay, you have to understand that to understand how we're going to solve the problem. That's why I emphasize that. So there's a physician in Camden, New Jersey, who has recognized what I was just describing and was able to identify the 1% of the population in Camden, New Jersey that was representing 30% of the healthcare costs. And what he was able to do, with the approval of the insurance company and the patients in the emergency rooms, was identify exactly who that 1% was, what building they were in, where they lived, and where they are. And then he started approaching them individually, saying, "Do you like going to the emergency room 3 times a week? And frequently they would say, "No, I don't." And then Dr. Brenner said, "Could I come over to your home with a health professional and see how you administer your medicine, your diabetes medicine?" He's sure. It's a true story. They go over and they find that this individual who has bad eyesight was putting in their medicine every day regularly, as they should. But they were injecting air and not insulin into their body because they had bad eyesight. And as a result, we're at the emergency room all the time. So what Dr. Brenner did was made sure that they actually took their insulin by hiring local people from the community, from the check cashing store, from the Dunkin' Donuts, whatever it is, and said, "How would you like if I paid you $500 a week to go visit these people, these 1%, and make sure they take their medicine, take them for a walk around the block, have a conversation with them, have a meal with them?" A near 50% reduction in health expenses within that 1%, translating to a 20 to 30% reduction in overall cost reduction for healthcare. It's called hot spotting. Identify the people that are most in need, and then in our society right now, the most in need, we ignore every way possible. The inner city of our communities, the sickest in our communities, the weakest in our communities. We want to pretend they don't exist because our society glamorizes and celebrates strength and is shameful of weakness as a society. What this is the antithesis of that, which is based on the premise that you are only as healthy as your weakest link. And in the case of health, identifying those most in need and helping them is the number one mandate of the system. Dr. Brenner is doing it. Not only is he creating explosions in health, He's creating a collapse in the cost of health. That same principle is being applied by David Kennedy right here in New York City at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, along with a series of judges across America, including one I would really recommend your users look or your listeners, excuse me, look into, named Stephen Alm, who was a judge, one of the great prosecutors, and was a U.S. attorney out of Hawaii, who is doing incredible innovations along the lines of what I'm about to describe for community health. Same premise. About 5% max, sometimes it's much less, 2% to 1% of any given community is really responsible ever for any of the escalated violent crime, ever, ever, ever. In South Central, in New Orleans, in Oakland, in East New York, in Detroit, the most violent cities that we have, the vast majority of the communities in those cities are not violent, just like most people aren't sick, okay? So what David Kennedy realized, along with others, is that if you can go into those communities and identify who that 5% is and figure out who the three most influential people around that person are, it's not me, it's not you, it's not some outside figure. Maybe it's their aunt, maybe it's the gang leader, maybe it's their little brother. That's why I call it custom motorcycle making. You have to go in and see what are the influentials around the person who is, in the case, the most agitated or the sickest or whatever the characteristic that is harmful to either themselves or the community, that is the community's responsibility to restore, to identify and restore, which is what we're seeing people do immediately in this country all over the place, in little oases of innovation and solution, like Camden. I can list many others. And what we are seeing when these techniques, David Kennedy's techniques of identifying the actual 5% that are responsible for violent crime, changing the threshold from there'll be no petty crime and there'll be no drugs, because I hate to tell you, there's petty crime and drugs in every neighborhood in America. The threshold to which we are holding these communities is a moral aspiration that actually doesn't exist anywhere in America. The reason David Kennedy is having so much success is because his threshold for the communities that are the most violent in this country is, please don't shoot each other. I'm not here to tell you not to smoke dope. I'm not here to tell you that there's not going to be the same sort of vandalism and whatever may happen. But you can't kill each other and you can't be violent towards one another. And with these techniques and those thresholds matched with massive innovations in the judicial system as the parole officers relate to their felons. Right now in America, we have this sort of grandiose vision that if we put somebody in prison for 20 years, it will teach them a lesson. What we've learned in the science is this, is that the net present value or the current aware value for somebody on the street between a 1-year jail sentence and a 20-year jail sentence is 1.6 times. The deterrent value, you don't want to go to a jail for a year, Gary, any more than you want to go for 20 years because your preference is to simply not go to jail, which is the vast majority of us, okay? And so the way we do parole right now is that there's no set engagement and there's basically it's up to the parole officer to decide, well, if I'm a lenient, it's like having a strict teacher or not. Depends on who your PO is. So it creates this culture of great inconsistency and a confirmation of the breach in the social covenant that we're talking about. Everybody's correctly identifying that the social covenant, so the social covenant with inner city black and Hispanic communities in America is broken. They're telling us that. We frequently don't want to acknowledge it because it scares us to acknowledge that. But when it is acknowledged, what happens is this. You see the system change to immediate jail time, 2 days, the second I see a drug test failure or a breach of probation. This is what they are getting, an 80% reduction, 80% in recidivism, violent crime, all the statistics through techniques based on this hot spotting and immediate intervention. I can tell the same stories around Salman Khan and education and experimentation, but I don't want to go on too much. The point is that I can do all of those things in Saranac Lake today.
I appreciate those insights. I would like for you to also address what I consider not just the symptoms, but also the cause. We have a war on drugs that is completely failed, a war on poverty that's failed, a war on diseases that have failed, but have become very profitable for those groups and corporations that are a part of it, including the for private prison population overseers. And so every time you put a person in jail for marijuana, in one case for 10 years for 2 ounces of marijuana, that doesn't help anyone except the people who get paid for that person being there. What would you say to going into the communities that have a disproportionate number of African Americans or Latinos in prison for committing the same so-called crime that a Caucasian would commit, showing an institutional bias, an institutional racism that we're afraid to address? That's part of it. Separately, I go to Camden. All right, I take food over to Sacred Heart Church. Michael Dowd, who was one of the Camden protesters back in the Vietnam, he's still there, still helping people in the middle of what has become this giant ghetto, either the first or second most crime-ridden, polluted, and impoverished city in America.
Yes.
You'd have to go out to Compton in California to find something comparable. And yet I ask, what has been done to de-ghettoize America? Not gentrify it, because then all you're doing is taking poor people who do not have the guidance and support systems they need, and you're pushing them someplace else and say, just go away. And suddenly we're going to take this block and make him nice big townhouses. I'm saying to change completely the tools we use so we can change that person's environment and their circumstances from being less likely to commit any crime or even something that many of us don't feel should be a crime, and that is taking these drugs. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, I mean, what David Kennedy at John Jay and Judge Alm in Hawaii and the superintendent in Chicago, the superintendent of police in Chicago, is now taking up these issues. I'm going to go out and see him next week. What they're demonstrating is that the most effective healing mechanism immediately is to abandon the insane logic of the traditional right, which is to lock them up and throw away the key. To abandon the insane logic of the traditional left, which portrays them as victims and feels a need to sort of lay off their own guilt about the situation into some sort of structure that does not actually benefit the people involved for the long term. And what David Kennedy and these others are proving with statistics. And these are methods that have been endorsed by everybody from Dr. Ben Chavis, who worked with Martin Luther King, to Russell Simmons, to Tim Dunn, who's an evangelical Christian from West Texas, who leads a massive justice reform group out of Texas called Right on Crime, who believes in all these techniques. Mark Meckler, who's a Tea Party leader, believes in these techniques. Many of the occupation advocates believe in these techniques. And they're remarkably simple. They say, identify the 5% in the community that are committing these crimes. Set a base threshold with them, which is you're not allowed to shoot people. Let them know with a consistent and transparent apparatus that every time you're in breach of your probation as a felon, you're going to go to jail for 2 days that day. You're not going to go away in a week or 3 weeks. The most important thing we're finding is that it's when I get you in breach that day, I put you in. Nobody wants to go to jail today. They don't care from a year to 20 years. Nobody wants to go to jail today. And so what they're finding is when you're forced to go to jail today for 2 days, and that they just stop doing it. The drugs stop. The violence stops. And there's nothing healthier for a community. I don't care whether it's Camden or Compton or New York or Saranac Lake. There's nothing healthier for a community than the decision inside of that community not to shoot each other. I don't mean to sound trite. The value to a community when people decide inside of their own community, there's something called pluralistic ignorance, which is very prevalent in the gang cultures in this country. Also, by the way, everywhere in this country. And what it means is when everybody thinks that everybody in the group believes something that nobody believes. And that is very common. So, for instance, the drive-by shootings or gang rapes or things that really get that occur in some of these cultures. And then you'll interview, talk to David Kennedy, you'll interview each one of those participants, and none of them, they all feel horrible. They didn't want to do it. They thought the other guy wanted to do it. And when you break those little bubbles of pluralistic ignorance inside of communities and realize that actually everybody involved with whatever the antisocial or aberrant behavior is, nobody doing it wants to be doing it. They would rather be doing anything other than that. But they're in this frame of brain that is their only thing they have is that crew of brothers. That is their family. And when people realize that their family, that the community cares about them, and that the community is going to have a social covenant with them, including the judges and the parole officers and the police who are part of that community, with a transparent mechanism of punishment for breach that's not get out of here and never come back, you're evil. That is, that behavior is antithetical to this community. We love you. We need you not to do that. You're going to go to jail for the next 2 days and then come back and please don't do it again, okay?
Let me add.
The effectiveness is stunning.
I would agree with that. Let me add just a thought to see what you think of this. When I was growing up in a small town in West Virginia, anytime any of us did something stupid, what would happen is that a group of individuals would always sit down with us, a grandfather, uncle. There was always some elders, and they would explain the consequences, not only then, but in the future. What if we encouraged in every community in the United States, not just in ghettos, that we start to look for those elders to be there as ambassadors of love, of direction, of kindness, so that you had people you could go to when you were confused about where you were at, you were angry or you were disappointed. Instead of exhibiting that as rage towards innocence, instead you had people who could advise you who were wiser, but also were part of your community. We don't have that in the United States. They have that around the world. We don't have it here. Native Americans had it. Why can't we do that as well?
Well, what David Kennedy is doing and what I have already agreed to do with David Kennedy, along with Russell Simmons and Ben Chavis and Tim Dunn out of Texas and Mark Meckler, is we have agreed as a group to begin an aggressive advocacy and escalation and scaling of what David Kennedy has already proven out, which is that community restoration, custom, we jokingly recall it, it's like making a custom motorcycle for every community. There is not a one size fits all solution from Texas to Birmingham to Saranac Lake to Seattle. Each community has its own identity. It has its own culture. It has its own way of being and its own divisions and alignments. And that's the brilliance of the David Kennedy's models is that it is based on directly identifying and helping to encourage and support the influentials in a given community, knowing that there's a variance. Where I grew up, John Raymond was the head football coach, was a very influential man in the community, for instance. There's other towns where there's also an elder teacher who can have influence. You don't know. It could be somebody's aunt. It could honestly be somebody's younger brother. It doesn't have to always be an elder. An influential is not just inherently somebody who's older, although that is frequently a critical component. An influential is somebody that those who are exhibiting the most aberrant behavior are the most likely to be influenced by, which, again, in the case of a 19-year-old, may be their younger brother as much as it is their grandfather. But the idea is this is what we are doing.
I would like – there is a coach that took over a very down-and-out team, a poor team in a poor town, and he helped them become winners. And when asked, he said, sports and football creates character. He said, no, it doesn't. It reveals it. I believe that if we went in a different approach where people are hurting and we're there to give them some support, understanding their problems from their unique perspective, that it would reveal who has strength that we didn't know but had misaligned with sources. Now, we don't have a lot of time left, but I want to also ask you, I'm 3 years ago, a year before any of the collapse on this program, I did a one-hour prediction of the collapse that was coming when everyone thought this was stupid, and I predicted six bubbles, including the hedge fund bubble, the equity partnership bubble, which has led to over 26 million jobs being changed, downsized, or lost over the last 32 years. But I also said just a year ago, and then again 3 months ago, I said, if the International Monetary Fund And if the European Central Bank go ahead and give the bailouts to Greece, demanding 22% reduction in their minimum wage and taking away 155,000 government jobs and selling off their national assets, they will win in the short term because they control, like ours, Congress is controlled. But what will happen is the people will go to the streets. First, they'll protest. When the protests are not met with any resolution, they'll burn their buildings. There'll be riots. When that is not met with any change, and when the international banking community feels, oh, now we're going to get our money, because, as you know, the vast majority of the money that's going to be given to Greece does not go to Greece. It goes to the bankers and in rollover debt. Then they're going to unseat their government. With that, Germany will influence that we better cut this tumor off so it doesn't affect the Northern European Union. But and so we have one less, you know, we have 26 and 27 instead of 27 European Union. But I believe at that point, it'll be too late. I believe that you'll see the same demonstrations and activity in Portugal, then Ireland, then Spain, probably not in England or not in Italy. But you're going to see some substantial social change. All the while, the major media is missing the underlying point. They never talk about what it's like to be a person adversely affected by monetary systems that you had no control over. Your thoughts, what you see happening, and where you believe this is going.
I have no idea where this is going. I don't disagree with your assessment of the risk as you laid it out. My goal and my intent as a journalist and as an advocate and philosopher is to drive our energy towards building the second sets of maps in our communities and in our country and in our electoral process, such that when we are taken to the crucible of extraordinary suffering among hundreds of millions of people, simultaneous to a demand to reconcile trillions of dollars in debt, which is a crucible we are on now, but we are coping with by currency manipulation effectively. When we get to that crucible, my hope and my intent and my advocacy is that we will resolve at that crucible as we did in 1945 after World War II. With the Marshall Plan and a global debt restructuring, a global release of the fraudulent obligation to repay into an invented paper currency that has done nothing of any value, nor has it actually ever existed. And yet the poorest and the weakest among us are being asked to consistently pay for it, as you just saw in Greece. And so my hope is that the more people understand that there are basically three choices: continue with the stresses of the crucible we're on, engage in escalated conflict and violence with one another, as we chose to do many decades ago, or as we realized after the last global conflict, we could simply make the decision to do a global debt restructuring and stop supporting the fraudulent nature of the economic structure and release a renaissance of growth and super innovations, which I am certain we are on the verge of achieving. That's why I'm honestly so excited, is that I know for a fact that as we fairly quickly tick through this transformation that you speak of and get through a Marshall Plan, that we can rapidly, we're seeing super innovations spring up all around us as it is, and we just want to accelerate that.
Thank you. Of course, I did some math on this. If we were to have given each small business person in the United States the same 0.25% interest the Federal Reserve gave in $16.1 trillion, and with the provision that up to $5 million for each $1 million you hire one employee at a living wage, that would have now gainfully employed 11 million Americans. Instead, we employed no one new, but the banks did well. Let us hope that we have this renaissance. And I know that there's going to be a lot more dialoguing on this. Dylan Radigan, author of Greedy Bastards, and a major voice. You can watch him, The Dylan Radigan Show, on MSNBC each day in the afternoon. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for the privilege.
I'm Gary Nall. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day, everyone.